From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll have a refresher course on the redistricting case before the U.S. Supreme Court and what could happen if the court rules in favor of Wisconsin and Maryland.
If they decide that the maps can stand in both Wisconsin and Maryland, then I think that opens the door to about as much partisanship as is imaginable.
Writer Liam Callanan shares the backstory of his latest novel, Paris by the Book.
Essayist Linda Fleshinsky considers one of the lingering gifts her father gave her.
Later, Radio Chipstone explores an exhibit of Japanese prints from the early 20th century.
They're sort of timeless scenes, often without people, certainly without modern clothing. These sorts of prints that look back fondly to the past were still popular.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. People in two states and around the country are anxiously awaiting a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. The decision involves congressional district maps drawn in Wisconsin and Maryland, which critics say are overly partisan, favoring Republicans in Wisconsin and Democrats in Maryland.
With a decision of some kind expected by the end of the month, WUWM's Mayon Silver asked political analyst Barry Burden for a refresher course on the issues at stake. Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison, and he says even if the court throws out the district maps in the two states, it's unlikely to have a direct impact on this fall's elections.
We're now at a point where it's too late, really, to make changes to this year's elections. In Wisconsin in particular, the candidates have already filed to run for office, and those signatures have been approved by the State Elections Commission. So the earliest the new districts could take effect, if there are any, would be 2020.
So if the court finds it unconstitutional, these redistricting, do you think the Supreme Court would give guidance on redrawing the maps?
It's a really great question what the court would ask the state to do as a remedy if they decide that the map is unacceptable. And I think there are a few different paths that we might end up going down. One is that the Supreme Court might tell the state legislature, do it over. You didn't produce acceptable maps the first time, and so now we've set a standard, and you need to make new maps that fit that standard. Another approach would be to essentially hire someone to work on behalf of the court and operate as a master to draw the maps and get those maybe approved by the state legislature, but certainly submitted back to the court. It might also send the case back down to the Wisconsin District Court in the Western District here, the federal court, and ask them to draw new maps. So I think there are at least three and probably more remedies that might be put in place, and we really have no idea at this point what the Supreme Court will ask to happen.
What would the criteria be to make it nonpartisan? You know, what would those guidelines entail? Any idea?
Yeah, so the issue in the case is about partisanship in the full statewide assembly map. And so the Supreme Court would need to set a standard for when a map becomes excessively partisan to the point where it's not constitutional. And there was one standard offered in the case by the plaintiffs coming out of Wisconsin. It's a measure known as the efficiency gap. The efficiency gap is a formula that gives a number as to how extreme a map is in favoring one party or the other. And so it might be that the court would say a certain value on that efficiency gap scale is the point at which the map becomes unacceptable, and the state legislature or whomever would need to draw a new map that is under that threshold. So that's one way they might go about it.
Did they have a suggestion in the Maryland case?
In the Maryland case, there are somewhat different issues at play. The efficiency gap was not being offered as the main standard that might be used. And that's because the Maryland case was not about the entire statewide map, but really about one district. And the efficiency gap is a formula that applies statewide.
Mm.
So that makes it somewhat challenging to put the two cases together because the legal arguments are a little different in each case. And then the kind of numeric bright lines that they might use to decide what's acceptable and what's not would probably be different.
What is the simpleton's version of what the issue? What are the two different issues in the two different cases or theories?
So they're complementary in some ways and hard to reconcile in others. What's complementary is that in Wisconsin, it was Republicans drawing the maps, trying to harm Democrats. In Maryland, it was Democrats drawing the maps, trying to harm Republicans. Also in Wisconsin, it was a state issue in the state legislature. And in Maryland, it's dealing with a congressional district. So they're nicely paired in that way that they cover a range of different issues and might be pulled together into one case or one set of opinions. But the legal theories that were offered in the cases and the evidence, those are quite different between the two states. In Wisconsin, it's an argument about the whole map, all 99 assembly districts, and the argument is essentially that Democrats' rights have been violated under the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment by Republicans who drew the maps, and that you can measure the infringement of those rights with the efficiency gap or other measures like it, and that better maps could be drawn. The Maryland case is a little different because it's one district where the Democrats tried to squeeze out a Republican office holder and turn that district into a blue district, and they succeeded at that. The argument there is really about the First Amendment rights of Republicans living in that district, and the plaintiffs allege that Democrats went after them because of their political beliefs, because they were Republican-leaning voters, and so that violated First Amendment rights. So even reconciling the theories, let alone the measures or other standards that might be used, is going to be tricky for the justices.
So why do you suppose they decided to fuse those two cases?
Well, they were both on the docket this year. As I mentioned, they do have some nice complementarities. The Chief Justice in particular was worried about having one case that would look like it was favoring one political party and hurting the other political party, that it might tarnish views of the Supreme Court and cause people to think it was a partisan body when they really don't want to be. So having two cases together that involve different parties taking advantage might be helpful. Having both the state and the congressional maps dealt with in one set of opinions also could be very helpful for just clearing that confusion about where it applies. I think also there was not consensus on the court about what to do once they heard the Wisconsin case back in October. And so maybe bringing the Maryland case in was viewed as a way to clarify things for the justices that would put all the issues on the table. But in fact, it looks like from the argument in that case that it actually muddled their thinking about it somewhat. There is, by the way, a third case out of North Carolina sitting off to the side that they've not heard yet and could bring into the mix if this gets dragged out much further.
And when you say if it gets dragged out much further, what do you mean, that they wouldn't come out with a decision? Or?
Yes, it's one possibility is that they will issue no opinions this month after all, and they will instead have a re-arguing of the cases in the fall, and they might merge the Wisconsin and Maryland cases, bring in the North Carolina case, hear them all at once, have a really robust discussion among the justices about all of them simultaneously rather than one at a time, and try to really set a new precedent for districts going forward based on those three very different kinds of cases.
Do you think that's likely, or is that what you're expecting?
It's hard to know what to expect at this point. These cases have dragged on for so long, and they're so different from one another, and the court is divided. You know, we might get lots of opinions coming out rather than one decisive one, or there might be just a majority of five against a minority of four. But setting the cases for re-argument in the fall, I think, is a real possibility.
Do you think that what do you think the impact of the case would be if they find the redistricting unconstitutional?
It would be pretty consequential. In Wisconsin, it would mean that the assembly districts need to be redrawn in a way that meets whatever standard the court has set. And it probably also means that districts in other states would need to be redrawn. If they adopted the efficiency gap argument and threshold that the plaintiffs suggested in the case, it's something like a third of state legislatures would need to have their maps redrawn, presumably before the 2020 elections. And if the Maryland case is brought in as well, there may be new standards for congressional maps. And so some of those districts may need to be redrawn as well. So I think it could be a very meaningful set of decisions.
And what if they find that it's constitutional?
If they decide that the maps can stand in both Wisconsin and Maryland, then I think that opens the door to about as much partisanship as is imaginable. The dominant party in each state will be able to take full advantage of the map drawing process, knowing that there are essentially no limits if the court has told them that in these cases. They can go as far as they want and not be worried about crossing a constitutional line.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science and the director of the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics at UW-Madison. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver.
Buying a struggling English language bookstore in Paris might not be a plan suggested by a financial advisor, but that's what a fictional Milwaukeean does in a new novel by writer Liam Callanan. We'll talk with him about Paris by the book when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If there are any themes that fiction readers have warmed to in recent years, they would include Paris and bookshops, sometimes bookshops in Paris.
But none of them have woven Milwaukee into that mix until now. Wisconsin novelist Liam Callanan's new novel features a Milwaukee woman married to a writer who suddenly goes missing. She and her two adolescent children go looking for him, a journey that leads them to buy a bookshop in Paris.
What do they find? Well, that is contained in the pages of the novel Paris by the Book, which came out in April. Liam Callanan, who is an occasional Lake Effect essayist, joined us in the studio recently to offer a preview. Liam Callanan, great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thanks. It's been a fun ride so far.
Well, good. as it should be, I would hope. When did you first go to Paris?
I first went to Paris when I was in college. And it left a wonderful impression on me, of course. But I didn't get back to Paris until years later with my family. And so I think the first time that I was able to go with my kids, it was probably in 2012 or thereabouts. And like many Milwaukee families, we looked up come springtime and realized that we needed to definitely have a spring break. And I was looking at flights to Florida and hotels there, and they were awfully expensive. And then I saw a Paris flight advertised come across, and I said, wait a second, we could go to Paris for less than it would cost to go to Florida? And the truth was, we could go for much less. And so I redirected our efforts, and off we went to Paris. And the weather was exactly like it is on the east side of Milwaukee where we live. It was cold and wet and rainy, but it was wonderful. And my girls were captivated by the city. And we wandered around town exploring nooks and crannies, guided a lot by their obsession and fascination with a couple of children's books, the Madeline series from Ludwig Bemelmans, and then The Red Balloon, which is also a film by Albert Lamorisse. And so exploring all those places really just kind of opened up the city in a new way to me. And on the last day of that trip, we went into a little English language bookstore that was kind of in the process of closing down, where it appeared, we didn't know that at first, but the place was kind of a very picturesque mess. And as we were checking out, the woman took a long look at us and said, do you think you'd like to buy the store? And she was half joking, but only half. And she thought we might be the right sort of family because our daughters clearly love books and I love books. And I was a writer. And so she thought we might be a good match. And for a long afternoon as we walked away from that store, we wondered if we might be a good match. We were trying to calculate exactly how long it would take us to lose our entire life savings in Paris. And we thought we would have a good 8 months before it all went south. Many people subsequently offered to work for us for free in the store, but no one ever offered to give us money to to buy the store. And so we didn't buy it. But in this new book, I do get a bookstore in Paris. And so that's just one of the wonderful ways that fiction opens up new worlds for you. You can kind of like write your way there. A little bit like, was it Milo in The Phantom Tollbooth?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kind of drew himself forward. So I think that's, I'm looking forward to that, too. Or Harold.
Exactly.
Harold in the Purple Crayon. Yeah. He drew the path forward, and I was doing that in this book as well.
You mentioned The Red Balloon, and I certainly remember the film The Red Balloon when I was young. I had these kind of their sepia-toned memories, partly because I'm sure the print I saw of the film was so faded at some level. But As you describe the red balloon figures prominently in this book, it occurs to me that maybe the memories aren't so much faded colors as it was that was what the film actually looked like. It is a Paris that is very gray except for this balloon.
It is. It's fascinating, the story of the red balloon itself, because it came out in the mid-50s, and it won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, which is ironic because it's probably only 30 words of dialogue in the whole piece. It's only 30 minutes long. And it's hypnotized a generation of generations of American kids, especially in the 70s and 80s when thousands of copies were distributed in American classrooms and people would always watch it during recess. And, you know, it sounds like you're like me. It was just absolutely captivated by this Paris. And I've always thought it was a strange film to captivate you by because it's a pretty bleak and gritty and gray Paris. But I do think that for a certain sort of artistically minded soul, that it kind of appeals to us all the more because it feels real in a way. It feels like we're not seeing Paris through rose-colored glasses. We're actually getting some sort of a real Paris. But of course, it's just another version of the Paris myth. And so, if anything, that kind of notion of kind of a gray and gritty Paris also appeals to some sort of deep part of us that we want it to be. You know, we want to be the one to kind of go over there and fix it. And I think that the way the red balloon haunts people, I think, is in part because of that. It kind of plucks some sort of longing deep inside us, which matches that gray and red landscape.
And in contrast, there's the Paris of the Madeleine books,
right,
which is much,
much sunnier.
Yeah,
and like literally sunnier because he's got a sun in a lot of shots. Although, to his credit, he does paint a page or two of them wandering through the rain. But those are kids' books. That's for a younger set. Although really not. I mean, the Red Balloon it goes pretty young too. But so the Madeleine series is, you know, to my mind, it's just kind of like painted with a lot more joie de vivre, I guess we would say. There's a lot more dash and color and style, and it's sunny. And I think between the two of them, between La Maurice and Bemelmans, between the Red Balloon and the Madeleine books. I mean, that's how kids went to France. I think that's how a lot of people still go to France. And I mean that metaphorically, but also, like, literally. Like, I think that those books take many, many people to France just because they're transported there. And so it's two different ways of looking at a city is how I claim it in the book. And so my book kind of joins that conversation where, you know, this young woman from the east side of Milwaukee is going off looking for her husband, who's just abjectly disappeared from their house one day, and she gets some clues that lead her to believe that they might be going, that he might have disappeared to Paris. Other people think he just disappeared into the lake because he left absolutely no trace. So,
and he's kind of a tortured writer.
Which is odd because I don't know any tortured writers myself, and I certainly am not one myself. But there's a certain type, and he's a tortured writer, and who also wrote children's literature, and so he was a big fan of both of these artists. And what he liked about them, which is kind of what I like about La Maurice and Bemelmans, is both of them were really complicated individuals. And so is Leah, the narrator of my book. She finds her husband Robert's pretty complicated. So off they go to Paris to kind of search for him. But then Paris itself turns out not to be quite what they expected, and they discover all sorts of things that surprise them along the way.
How did Leah emerge as your narrative voice?
That was a really interesting process. This was the book started a totally different way. I had written it in third person. It was from the husband's perspective, and it was there was a long part in Milwaukee, and then one day I was sitting down to write, and I stared at my computer for a long time. I'd reached kind of a pause point in the narrative. And something that I often tell my students, I teach writing, one thing I often tell my students is if you ever get blocked, just open up another door and try it a different way and maybe try switching point of view. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that. Today I'll write in the wife's point of view just to kind of see what she's thinking about. Well, it turns out she was thinking about a lot. That day she thought about 1,000 words and the next day 5,000. And then suddenly I had about 25,000 words all in the wife's perspective, and I thought, she is the most interesting character I've got, and she also has a lot more to say. And so I just hung on for the ride at that point. So she, very much a scene stealer, she wandered into the text and took it over. And a couple 100,000 words later, she's in charge.
And as we get to know her, she has always wanted to go to Paris, but the only Paris she has been to in the past is Paris, Wisconsin. Both Paris, Wisconsins.
Yes.
At a very early, maybe ideal moment in her marriage to Robert.
That's one of the things that fascinated me is that we do have a Paris, Wisconsin, just south of Milwaukee, actually. And I think that it's not far from where the new Foxconn plant will be. It's just off to the west of 94 if you're heading down to Chicago. And then there's another Paris, Wisconsin. At least the maps say that there's another Paris, Wisconsin out in the southwest of the state. But there, I couldn't find a sign out there. One of the things that struck me about both Paris, Wisconsins, and for that matter, these notion of all the Parises across the United States, there are more Parises in the United States than any other foreign capital. And I feel like this is a place that people have been dreaming of for a while. So there's a Paris, Wisconsin. There's certainly Paris, Texas. There's a Paris, New York. Supposedly, actually, the Paris, Wisconsin was named for the Paris, New York. I like that they weren't dreaming too big down there. They didn't want to presume to be named after Paris, France, but Paris, New York was a safe bet. But it just reminded me of kind of the thing that we do, which is to dream of being in a different spot, but then somehow to try and recreate and tend to that myth in our own backyard. And so I was fascinated by that. At one point, the characters take a world tour, but they do it all within the state of Wisconsin. So they go down from Luxembourg up north of Milwaukee. And
Belgium's up there as well.
Yeah, Belgium and Cuba City and Paris and the other Paris. And of course, there's New Berlin. So there's all these places you can go. And I just like this idea that people are kind of constantly tending to these stories outside themselves. And it turned out to be one of the things that my book was about.
Paris, the one in France anyway, is the setting for so many great works of literature. How well do you feel like you had to know it to credibly represent it, to do it justice as it is, as opposed to this, you know, idealized Madeline version that maybe we got when we were 5 or 6?
That was the most terrifying aspect of the whole thing, was because I was entering, my first novel was set in Alaska, and fewer people know Alaska as well as Paris. And Paris belongs to everyone, particularly Parisians. And so it was a big challenge for me to get right. And I have not lived in Paris. I visited many times, and I visited a few times more during the drafting of this book. And so every day that I would go to work on this, I would try to go to Paris in the sense that before I started my writing day, I would start with some language review, like French language review, just to kind of get French in my head. I listen to these wonderful sound artists. Luckily, the internet is a wide enough place that there are people who literally just wander cities, particularly Paris, with a ambient mic on and just capture the sounds of the scene. And so I would put my headphones on. I would download a 2-hour file of someone who was walking across Paris. That Paris does not fill with wheezing accordions and people selling flowers.
It's not all Edith Piaf songs.
No, it isn't. I mean, there's a couple people, but otherwise it's not. It's, it's Chilean pan flutes, and it's that two-tone European siren that sounds so distinctive. It's motos buzzing by. It's tiny little diesel trucks. It's people kind of shouting as they try the buses that honk and horn. And I realize, and that just put me in mind of, like, I want to make sure that the Paris that is here is real in the sense that it's an actual, like, urban place that people will recognize. So it's interesting. I had some people in Paris read the book, and it was interesting that they would disagree and agree over different things. Some of them would say, this is exactly like Paris, and then other would say, like, it was not. They were talking about the exact same thing. And I thought, well, you know what? I think I've got it right then. If they're disagreeing, then all the facets of Paris have been covered.
Liam, thanks. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Merci.
Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan's latest novel is called Paris by the Book. Our interview with him first aired in April.
Callanan will participate in Wauwatosa's An Evening in Paris this coming Tuesday. There is more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, Radio Chipstone takes us on a visit to the new Japanese print exhibit at the Chazen Museum in Madison. Lake Effect Weekend returns on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Drew Stevens is the distinguished curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Chazen Museum in Madison. While curating has been his thing for 30 years, Stevens says the distinguished bit came after his hair changed color.
This is contributor Jennifer Field's third visit with Stevens, and unfortunately, it's probably her last, thanks to his imminent retirement. But if it has to be goodbye, it's fitting that their final conversation is about Japanese printmaking. It's a subject that's near and dear to Stevens' heart. Entitled Watanabe, Japanese Print Envoy, the exhibition is about the revival of printmaking in the early 20th century.
Most of our shows were about artists, and Watanabe was not an artist. He may have made a print, although there's some argument about that. He was a publisher, and he loved Japanese prints. He started his work life as an antiques dealer, but really liked prints and found out that people love them and that they're hard to get. And this was around, you know, just after 1900. So his first publishing was to try to reproduce old prints. It went pretty well. He found some printers who could do it, some block cutters who could do it. And I think that that's part of what he needed to decide to do this, because this is the same techniques that were being used a century earlier, but with all new artists, all new designers, and that's what Watanabe brings to this. And he was so successful that almost immediately he has people copying him, and it really sparked a new interest in these published Japanese prints.
And what I like about him, Drew, is that the subject matter is a nod to the past.
Oh, yes. Watanabe, clearly he loved old Japanese prints, but he also knew his audience loved old Japanese prints, too. So there is one print in this show that has telephone poles in it, and that's it. The rest of these could have been a century earlier. They're sort of timeless scenes, often without people, certainly without modern clothing, no automobiles, no trains, although Japan was pretty modern by the 20s. It's just that these sorts of prints that look back fondly to the past were still popular. They're different in how they portray these things. The style's very different than it had been. It's very influenced by Western art, and so it mixes these old subjects, as you say, with these new artist styles.
Well, let's talk about some of the prints in the terms of old subject, new style. Is there one that stands out to you for that?
Let's see. You know, I actually, this is one of my favorites here. This is by a guy named Hasui, and he made literally 500 some prints during his career, 450 for Watanabe. So they worked together their entire careers. And this particular one, which is of Hikawa Park in Omiya, is of a sunset scene, but instead of looking at the sun is at our backs, as it were, and just the tops of the trees are lit by the sun. So they're turning red and sort of autumnal red, and the rest of the landscape behind them and the base of the trees is dark and mysterious looking. And I really like the combination of colors. I am a big sucker for tan and blue in certain combinations. And the other thing that really strikes me about this is that it's such a modern view of trees. You know, if we go down to this Fuji image, also by Hasui, and the one, well, one of two prints in the show that isn't published by Watanabe, and it's just to show that Hasui didn't work with Watanabe's entire career. But, you know, we have in the foreground these snowy trees and a nice sunset Fuji in the background. And in the middle ground, there's a lake with trees on either side. And the trees are very much described the way Western people would describe trees. But if we look at the reflections of the trees in the water, they look like old ink painting, like pine trees would have been painted the previous century, although upside down. And I think this is Hasui saying, you know, this is how we used to do it. And these new trees are another way to do it. But, you know, the reflection and the way we might be more comfortable with it, these are all just abstractions of what trees really are.
I see this idea of winter coming to an end and spring coming, sort of this transformative aspect in the work, and sort of like Not saying you're old, even though your hair is gray, Drew, but the old and the new, the coming in and the going out, and sort of seeing that view right here in this print.
It's kind of exciting, right? And as someone who's leaving, I'd like to think that sometime in the future, some modern, better curator will come along and give me this little bit of respect in some way, too. That would be nice. That's one of the reasons I love the print. Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I'm really, and one of the reasons why I also like this other one was that I thought about the idea of this tree being a tree that's been here for a while. It's got deep roots. It's set sort of its mark on the world. And then you see in the foreground or in the background what may be smaller trees, newer trees growing, set of their own roots, sort of like having their own time in the sun.
Yep. I'm sure that a Japanese audience would be very keenly appreciative of that. They do love a nice tree, as we all do, I guess. This sort of process of life is often built into these prints. It's an important part of the prints in the 19th century, and it continues to be here. We see a lot of changes of season, you know, and even in prints of beautiful women, there's always this knowledge that beauty is fleeting. And that, you know, the things that we see in the moment have to be appreciated because they pass so quickly.
Are you going to miss this?
Oh, yeah. I enjoy this. And, you know, there's like 14,000 works on paper here. And one of the fun things about the job is sort of going in there and wading through them and catching the ones that are interesting and thinking about them and putting together shows. So I kind of miss that. But, you know, it's not the only thing the job involves, and I think there's good reasons for younger people to take over the job too.
Do you don't strike me as someone who took this for granted. How did you keep this interest? Because I mean, I know part of it's the lighting and the prints and the excitement over retiring, but every time I talk to you, there's just an absolute joy and delight when you're talking about a subject.
Well, that's I think glandular. I actually can't help it. You know, I just do enjoy stuff an awful lot. I'm very fortunate that way. You know, I know people who have the same job that I do who just are kind of overwrought and a little upset all the time, and you know, I maybe it's because I'm in Madison where things are pretty cool, but it's such a great job and it's such a pleasure, a privilege to have had it. I really, you know, I can't complain about that. And so I feel a little guilty about being in it when, you know, plenty of great young curators are out there looking for work, so.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jonifer spoke with Drew Stevens, the distinguished curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Chazen Museum in Madison.
It's Father's Day weekend, and if you are fortunate to still have a dad in your life, hopefully you will have the chance to spend some time with him, or call him, or give him a gift. But Lake Effect essayist Linda Fleshinsky is thinking about a gift she received from her father.
The day before my father died of a painful cancer, the nurses had to move him from a bed to a gurney. In doing so, they lost their grip of him and dropped him onto the hard gurney. In pain, he let out a strangled groan. But that's not what those of us who loved him remember most about the incident. What we remember most is that within minutes of being dropped, my father, kind and gentle to the end, turned to the nurses and said, "Oh, dearies, you do such a good job. Thank you for being here to help me." In his agony, he was worried about what distress his mournful groan may have caused others. That was my father. During the difficult days of growing up in a world where we fail so often, he was just the antidote to self-deprecation and self-despair that we needed. When we did poorly on a test, when we lost a game, when we stumbled in some more painful personal area of our lives, he would just smile his smile and assure us that we were really special, that things would be all right, that this, too, would pass. And it always did in time. What never did pass was the sense we got from him and from my mother that the ground we walked on was safe and sure, that we could believe in ourselves, and that we could help others in this complicated journey because we had been so helped in our growing up years. I was reminded of the hospital incident last year over the holidays when I was at the post office waiting in line. The line was long, and even though the three postal workers were diligently attending to their work, the cordon of people had backed up. People shuffled, and finally a man behind me said, loudly enough for everyone to hear, including the postal workers, "Well, isn't this the U.S. government at work? Just more incompetence for our tax dollars." I looked up at the postal workers who continued stamping and sorting and giving change and smiling and saying thank you, and they didn't flinch. Still, it must have hurt. My mind flashed back to my father, who, being dropped onto a gurney, was able, even in pain, to turn to others who had failed and to tell them that he knew that they were doing the best they could in a trying situation. I thought of his ability to see that most of us are just out here, struggling for the light that is often elusive, succeeding sometimes and failing other times, and being what we are, human and imperfect and growing with each mistake and each success. We live in an age besieged with critics and complainers, with those who tell us what is wrong with everything, what is wrong with the younger generation, what is wrong with the older generation, what is wrong with liberals, what is wrong with conservatives, what is wrong with women, what is wrong with men, and more. In this backdrop, it is intriguing to consider what the world would be like if more people looked to see what is good and strong and right around us. For surely we see it every day. A government providing roads and trash pickup and immunizations and free public education. Young people working in schools striving toward productive and caring futures. Senior citizens serving as mentors and tutors to the young. Volunteers in virtually every organization asking how they can help. And children whose eyes, despite the problems of our times, still reflect light and love and hope and tomorrow. It's not easy to be human. Sometimes we speak too harshly to those we care about. Sometimes we fail at our job. Sometimes we don't add up the accounts accurately. Sometimes we give a test that is too difficult. Sometimes we don't study enough. Sometimes we prescribe a medication that doesn't work. Sometimes we take the order down incorrectly. And sometimes we drop an ill, elderly patient onto a gurney. Sometimes, despite our best intentions, we just plain do it wrong. But imagine what a world it would be if, in the face of someone else's mistake, we remembered our own shortcomings and considered what it is to be human. Imagine what a world it would be if we told others with our actions, our words, our eyes, that we know that they are who we are, all too human and trying just the same to do what they can in what light there is.
Lake Effect essayist Linda Fleshinsky lives and writes in Caledonia, Wisconsin.
We'll take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And welcome back to another edition of Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Leah Delaney, co-founder of Exfabula. Hello.
Hello. Happy weekend to you.
Happy weekend. So this, of course, is Father's Day weekend, and that ties in with the theme for this week.
Yeah, I did bring a couple stories. You know, it's like hotter than blazes this weekend. And I remember, well, it was last year, the year before, on Father's Day, my dad and I had grandiose plans of like grabbing a pint of Guinness over at County Clare and then heading out to the Esterbrook Beer Garden just to go bike out there. And we never made it off the patio of County Clare because it was so hot. But it was a lovely day. The sun was shining, and it was perfect. So today we brought a couple of stories, one of which is told by the father's perspective, and then the second story is told by the child's perspective. So it's a nice little balance that we have going on today. So today's show, we are going to start out with a story from Kevin McGee. Now, this was told, I don't know if you remember, I was talking about this story slam. The theme was TMI. Mm. And I went to that event and I sat there and I was like, I can't use any of this audio except for the story, actually. So let's listen to Kevin McGee's TMI / Father's Day story.
If any of you have ever been the parent of a small child, you know that the easiest way to bathe said small child is to take them into the shower with you, right? And so when you have an infant, it's a two-person job. One of you gets into the shower, adjusts the water, gets the temperature right. The other undresses the baby, hands them in. If you're the one in the shower, you then soap them up. Ideally, you do just one body part at a time because a soaped up baby is very difficult to hold on to. Some of you have experienced that. And so you soap them up and rinse them off. You want to make sure the water doesn't splash them right in the face. And so it takes a couple minutes to get them all cleaned up. Ideally, by the time you're done, the other outside parent is reappearing, towel in hand, to take the baby and diaper them, dress them, and so on and so forth. Once the child gets a little bit older, year and a half or so, it then becomes a one-person job. You take them in the shower, you soap them up, and then basically let them play in the water while you go ahead and shower yourself. So my son was about 2 years old, and I had taken him into the shower and soaped him up and left him to play with in the water and had begun to wash myself off. And I was, standing there sudsing up, and I happened to glance down, and he's standing about 3 feet away from me, and he's looking down, and he's looking up, and he's looking down, and up, and down, and up, and I knew right away what was going on, that essentially we were recreating a rite as old as mankind. But I decided it is best to just let things take their own course. So I continue soaping up, and he continues looking down and up. And he's doing this with a frown on his face. So I knew at some point something was going to happen, and eventually it did. After a certain point, he asks the question that is on his mind, to which I respond that yes, as he gets bigger, it will get bigger, which seems to satisfy him. His frown relaxes, but he continues the down and up and down and up until finally, as if to summarize what has been going on and what he's been observing and to close the discussion that must have been going on in his brain, he lets out the comment, "Welp, sure is a big one." Now I know it is wrong, absolutely wrong, for a parent to have a favorite child. What's more, to say that child is their favorite, but for at least one day, can anyone blame me?
And that was Kevin McGee's story from the TMI Story Slam.
I think all fathers are allowed to have maybe a favorite child once in a while. I thought that was very cute.
Yes, and I win in both directions because I'm an only child. Hooray. And you can't tell. So we are talking about Father's Day stories. Before we jump into our last story today, we have an action-packed planning session for this entire summer. So our next little teeny event that's going to involve the Milwaukee listening audience is that we are going to choose our themes for season 10. That's right, season 10. So if you get a chance, like late June, in a couple weeks, we'll be talking about a little bit more, but we'll have all the themes that you can choose online, and you can basically curate our next season of Story Slam. So that's kind of exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ooh, season 10, it's right around the corner. Just kidding, we just ended season 9. So at any rate, let's jump back into our final story of the day. We are talking about Father's Day stories, and let's listen to Ruby Brooks, who told this at our Faking It Story Slam back in January 2012.
My name is Ruby, and my best friends call me Ruby D. And for those of you that don't know her, she's an African-American actress and storyteller, and I couldn't take her fortune or her fame, so I borrowed her name. And I want to tell you a story, but I want you to take a tour with me. Actually, I want you to take a trip with me. And I want you to go to Graceland Cemetery with me, because I want to talk about my dad. And I love my dad, because he was the best daddy in the whole wide world. So I have to get his permission to talk about him first. So we're going to do a two-minute, two-second seance. So I want you to grab somebody's hand next to you, and then I want you to rub the back of their hand. And then my daddy had a nickname. We called him Dub D. And then I'm going to say, Dub D, can I have your permission? So, okay, got your partner? Let's go. Rub their hand. Dub D, Dub D, Dub D. Can we talk about you tonight? Yes, you can talk about me tonight. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Dub D. My daddy, he was the best daddy in the whole wide world. And my daddy was an entrepreneur. And you know what? He didn't get a loan from the SBA. He didn't get a loan from US Bank. But my daddy woke up one morning and he says, you know what? They called me Shorty. But you know, we in my family, we spoke Ebonics. So Shorty was Shawty. So he called me Shawty. He said, you know what, Shawty? I think I'm gonna build a garage. And my daddy did. He got his friends, and he went in the back of the house, and he built a garage, and he did body work on one side and auto mechanics on the other side. And guess what else? Me and my daddy, we from Gary, Indiana. That was when the steel mills were booming, and the town was grooming, and we was slicking and kicking and licking. But now, Gary's not such a good place to live anymore. But my daddy, he not only was an auto mechanic and could do body work on cars, but my daddy, guess what? He also worked in U.S. Steel. And he worked in U.S. Steel for 37 years. And one day he came home and he told my mama, her name was Lardella. He said, Lardella, I want to retire, because he had to get her permission before he retired. And my mom said, retire? You can't retire. You got 8 kids to take care of. And my daddy say, Lardella, I'm gonna retire. But you know what my daddy used to tell me? He said, Shawty, I wanna tell you one thing. He said, I might not have no education. He said, but I could count my money. And my daddy, he didn't never put any money in the bank. He had a safe out in his garage that he dug in the ground. And that's where he used to put all of his money. But my daddy, I loved him so very much. And when my daddy passed away, I said, Lord, I don't know what I'm gonna do if my daddy passed away. And my daddy did. But when I went to the funeral home to see my daddy, he was such a handsome guy. You could see his face, it was glowing, and his hands was even clean. Because when he used to work on garage cars, he had grease under his fingernails all the time. But his hands were just so beautiful. And I used to go to school, y'all probably don't believe this, but I graduated from Alverno College. And when I graduated, I went to a craft fair once, and I bought this little heart. And my name was on that heart. It said Ruby. And I looked around to see if anybody was in that funeral home besides me and my daddy, and it was just me. I lifted his coat up, and I took that little heart, and I slid it down in his pocket. And you know what? I went with my daddy. And so when they put my daddy in the ground, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I went with my daddy. And guess what? My daddy resides right now, or his shell resides at Graceland Cemetery. And he's got a headstone, and the headstone says, Sunrise, 1927. Sunset, 2002. And on that headstone, he got a 1979 Oldsmobile carved in that headstone. And under the bottom, it says, My daddy was the best auto mechanic in the whole wide world. And you know what else? He wasn't only the best auto mechanic in the whole wide world. My daddy, he was the bestest daddy in the whole wide world. God bless.
And that was Ruby Brooks. Oh, man, I don't think anyone's as big of a fan as her father as Ruby Brooks is. Ruby D.
Absolutely. I just love the fact that she had to do that little seance to get permission of her father.
Yeah, she's calling it out to the elders, you know, getting, you know, requesting the okay to go ahead and talk about him. I love that. It's beautiful.
You know, and I feel like Father's Day is such a great weekend to think about storytelling as well, because most dads have that story they like to tell, whether it's true or not. So it's kind of a tradition, I think.
Yes, it's so true. Family stories are just great pastimes to just keep passing on through generation to generation. And yeah, you're right. The factual content of it gets a little skewed along generations. But yeah, no, there's wonderful stories. And definitely thank you to all of the dads and the fathers out there in the listening audience. Again, we don't have any story slams per se coming up through the summer, but we might have a couple surprise events. I mean, who knows? But definitely keep an eye on exfabula.org for those potential events and or our themes that we will be sharing with you to vote on soon.
All right. You guys never call it quits. You're always doing something.
I know. It's a lovely grind.
So again, happy Father's Day, everybody.
Yay.
And we'll look forward to seeing you again next week, Leah.
Happy Father's Day, Dad. Thank you, Rachel.
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's 4 o'clock.